Your Honor.
Hello, everyone. This is Brenda Jones for Advancing Advocacy for the month of August 2017. And tonight we're having a quiz the board night. To go along with that, as you can see if you're on the meeting wall, we have our new, brand new NARSOL in Action special report for 2017, which many people have gotten, not quite everybody. At least I know mine has not yet arrived in the mail. I think the post office is hiding it. But we're going to be using that kind of as our basis for tonight's call. And the board, some members of the board have graciously agreed to join us on the call tonight to talk about things that NARSOL is doing, what the board is doing, and answer questions regarding those things. We have tonight on the call Larry Neely, who you know from other webinars. We have Sandy Rozek, our treasurer. Larry's the treasurer. Sandy is our communications person. We have Robin Vanderwall, who's our marketing guru, and we have Rick Dean, who is our volunteer coordinator, and Dolly, or Tammy, depending on how you know her, who is co-chair on the conference planning committee. I think I hit everybody, and I'm executive director and tend to be on all the committees. So anyway, welcome to everyone, and I think we are ready to get started. The first thing, I'll just introduce NARSOL in general to say that we have just been real pleased with the different things that we have done over the course of the year. We're getting more and more organized as a group, and our as a result of that, I think also starting to accomplish more things. If you are looking on the screen, one of the things you can see is a few little statistics we've managed to collect. We get a lot of correspondence, and all of this is handled by volunteers, and a lot of it's email, but we also get a large number of letters, mostly from people on the inside, and the statistics, a whole lot of people are interested in state information, things about a particular state they're going to or live in currently, and legal info, not surprisingly, is another sizable chunk. And then there's a smattering of other things, conference, things about NARSOL, looking for some support. And we have managed over the past year, 2 years, to respond to over 90% of the correspondence that comes in. We've tried to take that very seriously. We may be saying, sorry, we can't help you, but we respond. We try to get back to everybody one way or the other, and I've been really proud of the volunteers that do that work. We have roughly, well, actually, I've got 111, whether that's rough, that's average, contacts every month via email, letters, phone calls, and that's rising from year to year. I'll go from that to I'm going to ask Robin to speak now to just tell a little more about our board of directors. Robin?
Can I be heard?
You certainly can.
Excellent. Well, just to give kind of a summary of our board, of course, for a long time, people who have been involved from earlier years will be more familiar with us having called ourselves a team. And that's because for a number of years, what was formerly RSOL operated without having any legal definition, and so the initial members that helped to organize and to sort of guide and direct RSOL were self-identified as the team, as the admin team, and we still sometimes will slip into that nomenclature. But it really wasn't until 2011, after a period of some self-reflection and quite a bit of help from folks, many of whom are still involved, but some who aren't, that we finally put together a working set of bylaws. And in December of 2011, which, goodness, seems like centuries ago now, we actually adopted a set of bylaws, which for the most part, with some pluses and some minuses here and there, have been the guiding rule book or the operational manual or constitution, however you want to think of it, for our corporation ever since. And that set of bylaws has as a principle, I guess, typically we've tried to keep nine directors, nine people on the board. That hasn't always been possible because of vacancies and other types of situations. And as a reflection of that, right now we actually have eight members of the board, although I suspect that will change in the next couple of weeks. And those members, just by name, in case you're not familiar with them, are Rick Dean, Tamara Jackson, who we are probably more familiar with as Dolly Madison, the wife of the late president, Brenda Jones, who's our executive director and whose sweet and cherished voice you've heard up until you've had to hear mine, Peter Marana, Larry Neely, who's our treasurer, and Sandy Rosick, who's our secretary. Some of these people you've already heard. Paul Shannon is our chair. And, you know, Paul is luminous in the fact that the impetus for what would become RSOL sort of grew out of some advocacy on Paul's part way back in 2006 and 2007. And so we might safely refer to him as sort of a founding, one of the founding members, one of the founders of RSOL, or of RSOL. And then, of course, myself. More recently, as a matter of fact, in November of last year, 2016, we had occasion to reconsider the location of the corporation and in the process of determining how we were going to address that, we decided also that we really wanted to have an opportunity. Since the opportunity presented itself, we wanted to take advantage of that opportunity to make a change in our name, because we had always been uncomfortable and not really happy with the term sex offender being contained within the corporate name. And so that's how we ended up going from being RSOL to how we now self-identify as NARSOL. It wasn't a painless process, and I don't think that anybody on the board ended up with precisely their version of what that name should or could be. But, you know, one of the things I think is very important for folks to understand about our board, and I think one of the qualities of our board has been its collegiality. That's not to be understood as we never have heated discussions or we never have some tense interpersonal differences, because we do. But at the end of the day, we understand, I think all of us on the board, that the important thing here is not us, certainly not anybody on the board in particular, and not any particular individual. It's the folks that we strive to represent, the families, the loved ones, and of course the registrant population itself that is foremost in all that we do, and sometimes where we fall short, we regretfully do so because we understand that we're harming our efforts whenever that happens. How does one end up on the board? By virtue of the bylaws, there are, as I say, 9 members. 3 of those seats are what we call admin team seats, although they should now and will very, very soon be referred to as board seats. 6 of those seats are seats that are designated as electoral committee seats, and that means that the electoral committee, which is comprised of at least one representative, and I think actually the bylaws requires that only one representative from each of our established affiliates, those individuals that form that committee actually each year fill 2 seats or are responsible for appointing 2 of the seats on the board. So, and we're spread out. Each person who serves on the board serves a 3-year term, unless, of course, they're unable to and have to vacate their seat. And the terms are staggered. So we have a new class, if you will, of incoming members every year of at least 3. To the extent that it doesn't appear that those people change very much, has more to do with the fact that there's just, unfortunately, hasn't been an awful lot of people over the course of the last 5 or 6 years who have decided that they want to make themselves available for service on the board, or for whatever reason were simply not suitable matches for service on the board. With all that said, and I think I've probably said more than I needed to, I feel very, very good about the relationship that the board has one to another, and I hope that as we continue to grow and we continue to move forward, that this board will always endeavor to work in a collegial fashion and to put the interests of our body politic above the members of the board or any other entity or any other individual. So with that, Brenda, I am done with my little spiel.
Done with your little spiel. Okay. We did pick up one questioner, and I will take that person in just a second. I do want to say what we're going to be doing is, if you do have a question on the particular topic you've just heard about, you can press *6. I think if you're using the online features, there's a little, actually a little hand raising type of button right up there. I don't see it on mine because I'm already talking. And you can also go to settings and open up your little dial pad, I think, and press *6. Those of you on your phone, of course, *6 will work. I will take the question that I've got here. I'm not quite sure.
Hello, everybody. My name is Ed. I live in Illinois, and I am currently wanting to find out. My question is a legal one, and I'm wondering what the ultimate fallout from the Packingham decision will be, because I'm a professional writer. I write under the nom de plume of Edward Easton. I went to jail under that name as well, but I'm not registered under that now. I'm registered under my birth name because I live in the town that I grew up, and I had to register under that name because when I came out of prison, I had to, I had nothing with my old address or name on it or anything, so I had to use my birth certificate. That's the only thing they would accept.
Yeah. Excuse me. Illinois. Could I pause just a second here? Is there a question here for the board or about?
I was asked.
He's wanting to ask the board itself.
I wanted to ask a legal question. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. When we get to the legal stuff, we can give that we can see.
Okay.
Yeah. The meeting that this particular webinar is supposed to be to introduce NARSOL and about information about us. But Larry's going to eventually get to a point where he can
We're going to have a legal section here in a few.
We'll have a legal section a little bit later on. But yeah, if you don't mind, we'll
I didn't mean to interrupt on this. When I first came in, I couldn't get on because of I've got the latest version of Firefox.
It won't
let me learn. You know what I mean?
Okay. I do have one more question in the queue, and maybe two. Let's see here. Okay. I think it's Hans.
Okay. Can you hear me? Hello? Hello, can you hear me?
Not very well.
Not very well. Very, very quiet. Uh-oh. Yeah, can't hear you at all, actually. We'll let you try again.
Oh, wait, I thought at the end there I heard him.
Not well enough.
Hear me,
huh? There you go.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'll try anyway. My name is Dennis Munson. I got your email tonight. I've been in the organization for some time, and I wasn't quite sure what your call was about tonight, but then I realized after listening that it is a board orientated type of thing. The NARSOL thing was a surprise to me. I've noticed it's appearing different in the correspondence, and so I'm glad you clarified that.
Good.
I think what I'd like to do, I probably won't stay on this call as long as I thought, because after many years as I've been, I'm 70, I was a police dispatcher at the time. Mine was a family, stepdaughters. And so it's been 25 years now. Thank God, crime-free and had a good life since. But believe me, the Megan's Law has been a booger. But I appreciate everything your board does. I've considered possibly putting my name up for it. I think it being on the program this long, and I've gone to a couple of meetings and a couple of out-of-states, and I think right now you people are serving the board well, and I'd like to see other people get on and serve with new ideas and some fresh perspectives. So I will leave it at that.
All right.
And I hope you were able to hear me.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Again, thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. There we go. Next person. Can we hear? Did you mute yourself as well as? Yep. Not hearing still. I think that may be the same problem we were having before. We'll take our last caller for this round. Gotcha.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Did you have a question?
Is it my turn?
It is, sir.
Okay. Being in Pennsylvania, several decisions have come down in the state that were affirmed by the state Supreme Court in terms of the ex post facto sexual offender list that has changed and changed to everyone who is on the list, but they've gone with that as ex post facto punishment. In addition, Frost versus Allegheny.
I need to pause again here. I'm hearing another legal question coming on. Am I right?
Well, no, just I guess the climate in Pennsylvania seems to be trending our way.
This was supposed to be a question about the board service.
The things on the board, and what the board is doing.
Yeah, we're going to get to a legal section in a little bit.
So if you don't mind, I'm sorry to push, but we've got a number of different topics to cover. Larry's going to get back on and describe the things that NARSOL is doing regarding legal work, and that will be an opportunity there if you need some clarification. But again, tonight's focus is about the board, about NARSOL, about what we as an organization are doing, and a chance to ask the board members specific questions about the work that we're doing. So it won't be as much about legal, but believe me, I've saved Larry for last, so there'll be plenty of time, I hope, for questions, but I do want to give a chance for people to ask questions specifically about our work here. I'm going to clear the queue. I do see a couple of other people in the queue, but I want to go ahead and move on to the next topic for a minute. And then, again, if you have a question about what we're talking about, what we are currently talking about, then use your star six or other hand-raising function. I'd like to move on from that to I'm going to look at my screen because I want to move on. We've talked about the board, and I want to take a moment now to maybe just go. Let's go ahead and talk about our communications, particularly our print media and other relations with and that would be Sandy is going to speak with us a minute or two about that. Sandy?
Am I really bound to a minute or two, Brenda?
Oh, no, I'm just encouraging brevity here.
Hi, this is Sandy. I'm the communications director, and the Digest is our news magazine, our print magazine. The communications committee is made up of myself, Robin, and Larry, and the Digest committee is the same three people with Brenda added in. The Digest starts each month with me getting together all of the print material, everything that will go into it. From me, it then goes to Brenda, who does some layout, and with Robin will help with that, and there are certain things with visuals that Robin will do. Brenda gets it into the format that will become the flip book that you should be familiar with. Then it comes, it goes two different directions from there. What will become the print version then goes to Larry. The PDF goes to Larry, who expends a great deal of time getting it literally printed and put together and mailed out. The PDF also comes back to me then to prepare the email that you receive, giving you just a little idea of what's in it, and then you go to the flip book from there. And I also prepare a version for the CoreLinks viewers or readers. CoreLinks is a program that is in the Federal Bureau of Prisons where inmates are able to have email connection with people that they request. And one of the requests that they can make is to the communications committee to receive a email version of our digest. Our numbers, when the email blast that goes out through our email program, we send to almost 2,000 people. Larry mails, this last mailing was a little over 500 print copies, and it's growing constantly. And CoreLinks, the subscription is up to over 1,000 now. So we're getting very wide distribution of our news magazine. Other communications committee and communications type tasks that we undertake are press releases, editorials, website management, writing content ourselves, as well as soliciting it from others, and then getting it on the website. Correspondence, Brenda covered that. We have a couple of wonderful volunteers who do a great job with the correspondence, the written correspondence, and some volunteers that take in the phone calls and do an excellent job with that. We I try to maintain a relationship with as many journalists and editors and people in the media world possible, writing letters, thanking them for what they published or asking them to consider another point of view. And I will often, not always, but often get a response from them. Another area that the Communications Committee deals with is our social media, Facebook and Twitter. We have active pages on both. If you go to our Facebook page, please take a minute and do the review where you can rate us on a 1 through 5 star rating. That's something that I've just recently gotten started, recently getting that developed, and it's coming along nicely, and I'd like to see it increase.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks very much, Sandy. We'll pause there. I've got getting an echo. So somebody's got their phone on. Somebody who's currently unmuted has their phone on speakerphone or something. There, it went away. Thanks. Okay. I'll take a moment for questions regarding communications and media. If anybody has any questions, that would be star six again, or the raise your hand button. Okay, we've got a couple of questions, so let me take them. This is in regarding to media and communications, I hope. All right, you're on. You should be able to speak now, Gustav.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm just wondering, I know in the past my understanding was you would communicate with the media and it would be hard to get any type of response from them on this topic. Has it now become where the media, at least from what I'm seeing, is more open to writing about, some of the fact-based information that's being provided to them? Are we now being able, or are we now receiving more positive feedback from the media when we reach out to them versus what it was, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago?
Absolutely. And that is an excellent point, and we're very, very pleased to see this. Yes, when I first started, it was pulling teeth to get anyone to even listen to me when I wanted to ask them or ask them to consider a different point of view or ask them to allow me to send them some material or some statistics. They weren't interested. There has been a total turnaround, and there are several journalists who rather consistently write fact-based, very, very valid and good pieces and put out the information that we want out. So a big yes to that.
Cool.
And a question along those lines, would it be helpful if we're aware of who these journalists are so that we can possibly maybe like write a note to the editor? Because I think just like politicians, the more that they receive feedback from, I guess, the IE constituents, people actually responding to articles, perhaps they would then be more open to include those type of articles, or does it not work that way?
I think that's valid. There is a piece posted on our website where I did exactly that. I talked about several different writers and what they were doing, and the name of the piece is, I believe, Who Are Our Heroes? Or Modern Day Heroes, or something to that effect with the word heroes in it. If you look on our blog, I think it'll still be showing in one of the categories. And in that piece, I talk about several different journalists who have been very faithful in their rendition of the facts.
Okay. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
We do have a few more callers. I'll see if I can take a couple more. This is regarding communications and media and such. Okay.
Hello, this is Hans in Texas. I don't know if this is directly germane to the topic of media, but the question I have is about, we just sort of launched first question I have is, what is the relationship between affiliate groups like Texas Voices to NARSOL? Is it just an informal,
affiliation? Yeah, I can take that one for you in a couple minutes. We'll touch on that.
Okay.
All right. I might just do it now. But if you want to go ahead and ask the rest of your question, I'll see if it can be rolled up a little more.
Well, the related question has to do with we talked at our last Texas Voices meeting about launching an initiative to expand our membership. You know, of course, mm-hmm. This is just the Austin support group. It's a fairly big city. I think it's the fourth largest city in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of in coordination with Texas Voices overall, but what I would be interested in, it's probably too long a question to address in a webinar like this, but you might be able to point me to some resources for what has worked and what hasn't worked.
Definitely.
With other affiliate groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly.
To expand membership and outreach.
Yeah, that is something that a service that we try to help with, and Mary Sue is certainly very much aware of that, and she can check in with me, she can check in with the regional coordinators. Just very briefly, because it wasn't on the one of the topics for tonight, we have a combined system of We have affiliates, which are established groups. Established meaning, you know, they're incorporated. Maybe they have their C3 or maybe not, and a structure and possibly membership or, you know, something like membership. Then below that level, we also have people who've signed an agreement to be advocates or contacts, and these are individuals. But they're willing to work with us in a particular state to help answer questions, to, you know, research laws, to, you know, step out or provide support at whatever level they're comfortable. And they may be a smaller group that just isn't quite ready to, you know, go the full nine yards. So we have that in, say, 20-some-odd, would you say, Sandy? Between the one and the other, I know we're close to 30.
Yeah,
between affiliates and contacts and advocates that have at least some representation in the states. So, but definitely Mary Sue and whoever else is working on a new membership drive can check in with us. That's something we try to help our affiliates with and can do that. But that is probably all we can really handle on the call. But just, yeah, tell her to get in touch with me. She knows my number.
Okay. All right.
So, yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. So we'll move on. I'll take one more call here, and then we'll move on to our next topic. So go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. Is that me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was hearing. Yeah.
I thought you had me at first, but I was not a problem. I just wanted to call your attention to that excellent thing in the last digest that I got, where the guy on the inside was talking about sex offender treatment, the cottage industry, and how corrupt it is. I mean, that's an excellent example. You need to do more stories on that, because I'm trapped in that same situation, except that I haven't been recidivism, or I've completed my sentence, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But I'm still being held prisoner under that, because I refuse to put up with their bull crap. You know what I mean? And that's because it's exactly the way he described it. You know, that's been in my experience and the experience of everybody in that group, captive group that I was in.
They're all
scared to death because these people control whether or not they go to prison. I was a little better off because I had completed my sentence, you know, but I did some legal research and I discovered that the Cruzan decision that, what's his name, wrote years ago, and a couple of other ones are in direct contradiction to what these people are doing. You know what I mean?
I do. We are going to have to go ahead and move on to the next topic, though, at this point. Thank you very much for the compliment. And
I'll ask the legal question I have for later.
There
then,
you
okay?
go, later on. Yes, right. sir. Okay. We will need to. Next, I do want to mention our sort of our more educational part of NARSOL on the screen. We've got our webinars and we've got our conference, and I want to ask Dolly, a.k.a. Tammy, to talk a little bit about what our conference is all about for those who might not know, and then I'll touch a little bit on webinars. So, Dolly, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Yes,
all right.
Brenda.
Sure.
All right. So I'm Tammy Jackson. I'm currently a board member. I'm also known as Dolly. It's been a name that I've used for quite some time. I act as co-treasurer and co-organizer for our conference planning committee. We are getting ready to unveil our 10th anniversary conference next year, which will take place in Independence, Ohio. Our NARSOL has been having conferences, it's hard to believe, for 10 years. The first one started in Boston. We've seen an average of about 150 to 160 attendees. We've tried to diversify on many topics at each of our conferences. We've had them at various locations around the states. And people seem to really be able to connect and collaborate even after the conferences are over. I mean, it's a wonderful experience for our members and for new people that are coming into the advocacy arena. So with that being said, I will kind of open this up for questions about our conferences, if anybody on the call has anything they'd like to ask.
Well, I will definitely add to what Dolly was saying. If anybody has questions, the thing that most people, the first time they go to a conference, often get out of it is just a sense of, I don't know, relief, connection, because, you know, so many people with this issue, whatever part of the issue they're involved in, you know, often feel very isolated and a little hesitant to mingle and socialize and such because there's this thing in their background, you know. And so here you are in a whole room, big room full of people who get it. And it can't be understated how cathartic that is just in and of itself. And we often learn so much. And then, of course, there's lots of advocates who come year after year, and it's like a homecoming. You get back with the folks that you know. So, you know, that's also a helpful thing. We don't have any questions so far, Dolly, so I'll go ahead and just mention that the webinar
Hello.
She might have got zapped. Are you hearing me okay?
No, we're hearing you fine, but these people that have these high-tech devices tend to be having problems.
It seems like Brenda definitely, at least she's, her voice is gone. The screen is still there.
Yeah.
Okay, where were we?
Well,
Brenda was going to talk about the webinars, and I don't think I can speak to the webinars. Can Robin possibly speak to the webinars while we're waiting?
Well, we do two webinars right now. Obviously, this is one of them. Advancing Advocacy tends to be topical. We'd like to be doing these once a month, but sometimes it's more difficult in certain months than others. I'm fairly certain that Brenda would want to make mention that we could use additional help in organizing this particular webinar, Advancing Advocacy. And when I say organize, really looking for individuals who have an idea about a topic that would be useful for our affiliates and would be informative and educational, and that they might learn something. Tonight's an unusual advancing advocacy. They might learn a few things, but it's not as specific. Brenda, I think you're back.
I am back. Thank you. I have had more trouble with my connection this evening. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm going to finish.
Please do. Happy to have some help.
We also have NARSOL in action, which those of you who've attended those particular webinars are more familiar with Larry's involvement in them, and they typically are, in fact, I think they're more or less exclusively, at least lately, they've been more exclusively devoted towards legal topics. So if you want to know, and we have some very good guests too. Larry, do you want to step in there and talk a little more about NARSOL in action?
Sure, Robin. Those calls have been heavily related to important developments around the country in the way of cases, but it doesn't have to be that way. It's just that's what's been happening. There's been a lot of important cases. Very exciting time. We've intended to focus on helping people with their advocacy in a similar way. NARSOL in action might be blocking something in a state or helping pass something in a state, and connecting the national with the state people. That was my original idea when we started doing these calls. But then people started asking, "Well, what are you doing? What's happening?" So as more and more cases have been unfolding, we focused more on the cases, but we'd like to do both, and I could use some help also, because to put together one of those calls, I put together a topic, a guest, and I prepare questions in advance for the guest so that it flows smoothly, and it's a lot of work in setting up a call. I don't typically enjoy just sitting there telling a person to speak and them having no direction of where we wanted to go and what we're hoping that our supporters and followers get out of the calls. So I typically put a lot of planning. Those questions are planned in advance before you hear them.
Mm-hmm. Brenda, I had simply made mention that you might be seeking some additional help as well.
Yes.
With
Yes.
advancing advocacy.
I certainly am. Jennifer, who regulars remember, has had to step down due to family obligations, and so I'm running it solo tonight with the help of the board. So definitely could use some help there as well, because as we do generally take a little bit more of a lecture and Q&A format, but that still requires locating somebody that has some useful things to say and getting them arranged and scheduled and so on. So still could use some help. Are there any questions on conferences, webinars? I haven't seen any. Even when I got kicked off, I was still able to see. that.
Since we mentioned it, let's at least point people. If anybody on the call has a particular interest in helping in this area with webinars or in any area, and you have not done so, if you go to our website and you scroll over to get involved with just one of the menu items, you drag that down, you'll see at the very bottom it says volunteer. If you hit that, it'll take you to the volunteer page. And on that page, you have two options there's two tabs essentially right underneath volunteer on the left of the page. And if you switch between the tabs, there is the difference between a list of the needs that we have that are ongoing, and then the second is the actually application itself, and you can fill that out and send it back to us, and somebody will follow up with you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. We've just done such a wonderful job. Nobody's had any questions for us on this one.
Is the screen sharing back?
Oh, did I fail to? I'm sorry. There we go. I forgot when I got kicked off, I'd turn that off. So let me turn that back on again. Thanks for letting me know, Larry.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think I've opened up a new page there. We've got some. We are getting close to dealing with. I mentioned the state affiliates and volunteers, so we picked up that a little earlier. The only other thing on the page we were on was just very briefly the two projects that we're doing. And I will keep an eye out to make sure I don't drop again. The two projects that we have going right now that I especially just wanted to touch on was Humans on the Registry and our Fearless groups. Humans on the Registry is a new project we've got going, a separate website, which we're encouraging registrants to write a story about themselves, tell about themselves in a positive light. We get we already have Tales from the Registry, which is another site where you're welcome to come and vent and complain and offer offer words of advice about how to avoid going down into a black hole. But the Humans on the Registry, we're trying to look for a more positive angle, because there are people out there who are on the registry and yet they've managed to succeed. They've managed to find a way forward in spite of being on the registry. It's different, but it's a success. And they've found some hope. And so if you have a story like that, we'd love to hear from you on Humans on the Registry. Fearless Groups is another project that we've got going. It actually was originally inspired by Mary Sue's support groups. The Austin group is probably one of the oldest of those in the state of Texas. And that is set up similarly to the way a 12-step group may be set up, with certain educational component and also a support component, where people can form a community, support each other, and help each other over the hurdles. And this is it's independent of NARSOL, but we're trying to get it kick-started, and we hope that it will take off and kind of move forward on its own eventually. But it's something that's sorely needed, and it's often an easier way to start a group going in a state than trying to launch immediately into incorporating and that sort of thing. Just get to know each other first and build that community up, and then go from there. You can find out more about that on our website. So I'll just touch on that briefly. Does anybody have any questions about the projects or about webinars? Just in case there been any, again, *6 if you have questions about any of those things. Yep, they're all waiting for you, Larry.
We only have 6 minutes left, so
yeah.
I don't have to take my question.
You won't have to take. We actually usually go a little longer on advancing advocacy. So once we get going into the questions, we'll go from there. So. And we've talked about volunteers. Rick's been on the call. He hasn't said anything so far, but he's our volunteer coordinator. So before we move into that, is there anything you want to add about volunteering, Rick? If you're
yes, being that we have some digital glitches from time to time, and I do lose emails or they don't even get routed to me, mm-hmm. If you've put in an application and you've not gotten a response, please shoot an email to volunteer@narsol.org, and I will get back to you as soon as possible.
Yes, and like I say, we've definitely had some email glitches recently. So if you don't hear from us, submit a contact form if that doesn't work, because the contact still seems to be working okay. We're trying to get that sorted out now. Okay, still no questions in the queue. They're all waiting for you, Larry. So the last page that we've got is about litigation and about our legal project that we have going. So if you could start, Larry, and tell us what the legal project is about, and then we could move on from that to some of the things that we're doing and have done recently.
So, hopefully Robin will help me out since there's so much going on in his state. But the legal project, we've got kind of an informal group called the Scarlet Legal Action Project that we identify cases of interest, there's a deluge of people all the time contacting us about their case. They've gotten a bum rap. And unfortunately, as with any other organization, regardless of how large they are, whether they be the ACLU or whether they be the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, whoever it is, we really can't do those type of cases. So we try to do what's called impact litigation. We try to identify cases where the impact would be the greatest, and if those cases would lend themselves to our assistance, because we still don't really have the resources to initiate cases from scratch. So we identify cases that hopefully are in the process underway that we can join and lend our support to. And that project has identified over the last few years a number of cases that we've gotten involved with and helping out. Now we track a lot more cases that we're not actually helping with that we've identified as impact litigation, and we certainly lend our moral support, but we try with our very, very limited resources to focus those on cases which are a very high priority that we've identified through the project. We don't believe that people should be thrown out of their homes, so that's a high priority for us. So we've allocated some resources on a challenge we can talk about in that area of Rhode Island. We don't believe people ought to be banned from the Internet, although we didn't bring that case directly. That was brought through North Carolina, and we were connected to that case on Packingham from the almost the very beginning. We've in terms of registration, retroactive application to registration requirements, we don't believe that there should be a registry, period. But if there is going to be a registry, we don't believe that they should continually jack up the requirements and enhance and keep stacking on. So we identify that as a priority zone to try to draw a line in the sand to say, no, you can't keep adding on. So that's another one of our priority areas, is to stop the constantly encroaching beast from swallowing up more people, more offenses, and ever-increasing requirements in terms of residency and proximity. Residency and proximity restrictions are a high priority for us, because if you can't live anywhere, it's kind of hard to be a successful person if you can't work anywhere. So we've identified a few areas where that we would like to deploy our very limited resources to fight, and we've been somewhat successful in deploying those resources where we've had them to deploy. We're looking. Brenda, do you want me to get into individual cases, or do you want me to just talk about the generalities here?
Probably just generalities, given our time. But you're welcome to hit some highlights if you like. That's fine.
So you know, the board of directors just recently identified a case in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's the largest circuit in the United States. It encompasses the most geographic territory and the most population. And there's a case where a statute was declared unconstitutional because it was a strict liability offense, and the only defense a person had was to take the stand and prove that they did not have any sexual intent, which is difficult to prove a negative. So the Arizona lawmaker shifted the burden to the defendant, and we had a very determined individual who brought a claim through a process that seldom works, but he was lucky and fortunate and persevered, and it worked, and he received a finding of unconstitutionality by the federal district judge. And we have decided that we're lending our limited resources to try to preserve that victory, because if that declaration of unconstitutionality is able to be saved through the state's appeal and the Circuit Court of Appeals agrees, then we will see strict liability burden shifting come crashing down all across the Ninth Circuit, because that will be binding law of the land for those states. So that's the type of thing that NARSL does with our limited resources. We try to focus on areas where we can have an impact on the greatest number of people with the limited resources that we have entrusted to us. But there are other cases that we can talk about. You know, the Packingham case is on everyone's mind. There's been a recent state Supreme Court victory in Pennsylvania that's on everyone's mind, and that was our last webinar where we talked about that case. We're just excited because there's so much going on. That Sixth Circuit case out of Michigan, that where the Sixth Circuit found that the ever-encroaching registry had gone past what could be considered conceivable a regulatory scheme, and they said that could not be applied retroactively. So there's just a number of challenges going around the country, and the courts are finally seeing things through the perspective that we've been arguing. But these cases have taken a long time and a lot of sweat and tears to work them through the process and a lot of financial resources. And unfortunately, that's one of the things that we lack is sufficient resources to be on all the battles that there are that need to be undertaken. So I'll pause and see if anybody has any questions. And
all right.
If you do have a question, please try to get a question rather than a speech about because the speeches devour so much time.
Right. Yeah. As we are going to open it up to questions. If it could be questions about NARSOL's role in legal, you know, our legal efforts, and not a personal question about your particular case, this isn't the right venue to do that. But if you do have questions about NARSOL's work in legal, what we are doing, what we might do in the future, now's the time, *6.
Well, Robin, you can feel free to jump in here about your North Carolina case and then the 10th Circuit case that you coordinated the amicus brief on, because those are important as well.
If I jump in at all right now, what I'd like to say is what was a theme to what you had to say, and that was the phrase limited resources, which you mentioned probably 8 times. And it's a very important theme, and I want people to understand that our limitations are significant. Also, going back a little bit to my speech earlier, my presentation, you know, nobody makes any money doing this. You know, the folks that are on the board, we're an all-volunteer board. We're an all-volunteer organization. So aside from the cost of seeking funds, all the money we raise goes to do something. And so the more money that we raise, the more we can do. As simple as that. So anybody who's on the call tonight, if you did receive our recent mailing, which included the digest, the special digest, and a little brief sort of presentation of the legal opportunities that are presently before us, if you have it in your heart and you have it in your pocketbook to do something to help, then please do that, because the more that we do and the more money we have available, the more resource we have available, the more cases we can contemplate. And one promise we will make is that money that we raise to do whatever we do in the legal world is going to be spent wisely, because we're not going to go chasing after something that we don't feel has a very strong likelihood of being successful on the merits. So I just wanted to add that, because I think it's important for folks to understand that we can do a whole lot more, but we do have to, obviously, we have to work within the budget we've got.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks. Well, we did get a few questions in as you were speaking, Robin, so I'll take our first one. Go ahead. You're back on the air. I know you were here before, but I think you've muted yourself.
Yes.
There you go.
Now you can hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I think this falls within the legal area only because, as I look on the website, there's talk about a class action. The question I have is in reference to contacting Facebook and the ability to, as a registered citizen, have access to Facebook. And I know that they haven't responded from what I'm seeing there. But is there something that can be done there in terms of some sort of legal action, given that now apparently one of the cases made the social media and the Internet kind of the equivalent to what used to be the public park, and so it's a limitation of free speech. Is there a connection there that can be utilized to some sort of legal action?
I believe that, there is such a connection and there is a conceivable cause of action. That's going to be one of those that's going to require very creative argument. We're going to have to equate it to a public utility type of argument, that a public accommodation. You know, as the case law has evolved on public accommodations, I think we can move in that direction on social media. The framework in Packingham is there. They did make the connection that the social media is the public square. But what people have to understand is that the constitutional protection is against government intervention. And you don't have a right to someone else's microphone. And they miss that connection. But you do have the right to public accommodations once something is determined to be a public accommodation. When you go to the utility company, you apply for service. They have to provide it if you're in their geographic service area. So I believe that's something could develop. It's going to take some time, and I wish I could tell people that it would be quick. I don't know that I can, in good conscience, say that it'll be quick, but I do believe that that's an area that could be developed for further expansion in terms of people's right to access social media.
Yeah, I agree, Larry. I want to add to that when you hear the phrase class action, in no scenario that I'm familiar with are you talking about a constitutional challenge. So whenever you see class action associated, which first and foremost, there are very few class actions anymore, but nevertheless, when you see them, typically you're talking corporate lawyers or lawyers who are being provided a lot of lucre on the front end of that action. And that's another reason why it would be, I think this area of the law, as Larry points out, has got to evolve a little further before it's possible to attract an attorney who's willing to say, yes, I'd be happy to take that case on pro bono or in some modest fee sort of setting where we could actually afford it. And until that evolves sufficiently, it would just simply cost too much is the biggest problem.
All right. Well, we have a couple more questions. So thank you very much for yours. We're going to move on. Next caller.
Yes,
sir. Yes, it is.
This is not audible for me.
Yeah. We're having trouble understanding you. Are you on a speakerphone by any chance? Could you switch?
Yeah, I'm in an area where it's a little bit of a... Can you hear me better now?
Better.
Right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, that's better.
Can you hear? You can hear me now. Okay, good.
Yes.
I wanted to ask, how long is it? Do courts have any kind of obligation to answer a filing? I mean, Illinois Voices for Reform has put in has filed a case way back in May of 2016, and they've heard nothing yet. And I myself have a case that I filed a month later in July of 2016 to get off supervised release, and I've heard nothing back, not even whether or not the magistrate had been picked and was working on it or what. And I'm just, do I have to file a mandamus now or what?
I know my experience with that is there's a lot of hurry up and wait when you're filing lawsuits. But Larry, would you say that's accurate?
Well, on the Illinois Voices case, I do believe that there was a stay granted because they're waiting to see how other decisions play out. But I'm not absolutely certain of that. In terms of, do they have an obligation to answer? Yes and no. I mean, there's procedural delays that can cause things to not go forward because the party hasn't done something they need to do. When you are the plaintiff in a civil action, you have an obligation to move your case along.
Mm-hmm.
So you file your complaint. the state or your defending party, whoever it is, files a response. Then you file a reply, and then you start the process of preparing your case for trial if it's not going to be a settlement. And if you do something pro se, lots of times cases languish because the pro se person has no idea what to do next.
Because we're not lawyers, you know. I mean, we try to be. We try to be, and we try and study while we're in the joint, you know, to make sure.
Well, the court is a neutral party. The court is not there to help you.
Yeah.
I know that, but there ought to be somebody there, that, you know, because most of the people that I talked to in jail didn't know beans, you know.
Right.
They said they did, but they don't. You know,
the disadvantage of going pro se is that all the stuff that you need to do, you need to familiarize yourself with the rules. If you're in federal court, I've done that.
I know the Supreme Court has rules, the appeals courts have rules, you know.
Yeah.
I've studied all that, and I've read a lot of books on it, and I'm way, way ahead of where I started, which was from nothing. And what really has bothered me of late is noticing that the rules on the filing for a quorum nobis, from what I've been able to gather, the judge has no obligation whatsoever to answer that. If you file it and you're sentenced in court, they could just ignore it with no penalties at all.
Well, a quorum nobis is a very rare, extraordinary remedy that there's very, very, matter of fact, in our state, they've been abolished. We don't even have that. But some states still do have that. But yeah, in terms of your question, it would behoove you to either understand the process or, if you can, retain counsel, because there's things that you need to do to move your litigation along.
Oh, I would if I had the funds to do it, but, you know,
yeah.
Lawyers like
good.
Money.
Thank
they
you.
Like lucre.
All right. Well, we're going to move on to the next question. But,
okay.
Thank you very much, sir. Next caller.
Yes, I'm from Illinois, and I was wondering how Nasrallah selected the Packingham and the Arizona strict liability case to get involved in. How did you hear about them, and how did you decide to get involved in them? Thank you.
Sure.
Well, we hear about them through word of mouth, through a number of ways. I mean, there's a NARSL member brought the case from Arizona to us in terms of the Packingham case. I think that was through Robin's connections. But they come to us through a variety of ways, through Dobbs Wire, through just announcements of decisions. Normally, we're not on the initiation side of a case. That's a rarity for us because of the prohibitive cost of litigation. So most of the cases we're connected to, we're connected after they're already underway, with the exception of the new North Carolina case. We have not initiated any causes of action.
But in terms of making a decision, I think, like deciding which ones to pick, again, I think we're looking at, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're looking at how broadly might it impact, you know, how many people might be impacted by a positive decision, and then what else?
We're looking at with the strict liability, that's such a huge problem. It's all over the nation. Legislatures have dispensed with, they've made it easier at the behest of victims' advocates to secure convictions, so they've been eroding the burden of proof and making it easier for prosecutions to move forward. So that is a nationwide problem. So it didn't take a lot of study for us to figure out on that one. And then when you can hit yourself to a case that's already been won, I mean, that's even money in the bank, because
that
we're on the right
the
side
of the
appeal. So that in that situation, it was an easier choice for us because we were on an issue that's been very important. We've had presentations at a number of our conferences about strict liability in Atlanta. We had Professor Carpenter and I worked on that not this past conference, but the conference before. It's been a big concern of ours, and it's a big concern of most criminal law practitioners, defense mm-hmm. attorneys. So we identify it fits within our priorities, as I said earlier. It's not an individual case at all. I mean, it's an individual case in the case of this person, but we don't tie ourselves to that person. We're looking at the issue of the strict liability. You know, Packingham, nobody knows who Packingham is, except that Packingham had the courage to go to trial and challenge the constitutionality of the statute and was able to keep the fight going until we could attach ourselves to the fight. But Robin, did you want to jump in on Packingham and how that one came to be?
Probably most important to explain that there are two types of litigants in what we do. There are litigants that are charged with a crime, such as Mr. Packingham was, and so the trajectory of those cases are a bit different because they go up through an appeals process, which is based on the criminal side of law. You know, law is made up essentially of two heads. There's the criminal side, which many of us have experienced, and then there's the civil side, which is a bit different animal. So with regard to Packingham, there was really no opportunity for anyone to really come in to that case until it was in an appellate setting, and really until it gets to a point where you're talking about a court of highest review, such as a state Supreme Court, or in the ultimate situation in Packingham, the nation's highest court. There's really no opportunity for anybody to, any outside group, any third party to come in and say, well, we think it ought to be decided like this. And that's what we did in Packingham. To answer the question more specifically, you know, we're like a sponge in the sense that we have a presence, and we've got some fairly deep tentacles at this point. So if it's a significant case, we're very likely to find out about it just by accident, because somebody somewhere is going to send that information along to us, and then we can evaluate it and decide if it seems to be within the scope of our resources and also fits sort of the criteria, which is not a well-developed criteria, but I think a functioning and well-thought criteria.
Yeah. So it's really its impact, you know, broad impact, and the merits, I guess, might be a word, although maybe not in the strictest legal sense. Just the likelihood of success, you know, of a good, strong, you know, because the case itself is strong and the situation is strong. Okay, so hopefully that helps you. We're going to move on. We've got a couple more questions, and we'll probably start wrapping it up. If anybody at this point has a question for the board on any other topic that we didn't happen to hit, you know, specific to NARSL's work, you're welcome to go ahead and press star 6. I've hit all the topics we're going to hit, and we're just taking a few more questions. I've got at least two more in the queue that I think are supposed to be about legal stuff. So, all right. Yara?
Yes. Do you all ever get involved with civil commitment cases, and how do you fight those cases?
We have not been directly involved with any case that I'm aware of, and the fighting those has not been very successful in terms of the challenges. As you know, there was the case in Minnesota where the Eighth Circuit overturned the trial judge, and so civil commitment has been a tough one to fight. But Robin, you were chomping at the bit.
Yes.
Well, I'm not chopped in the bit. It is a difficult area for successful litigation because the court, the Supreme Court, has shut off many of the prescient constitutional arguments that would normally be effective, and so, you know, again, it doesn't those. Civil commitment cases do not fit very well within our criteria, not because we don't believe. Now, I will make sure you understand, we totally oppose civil commitment. But if you're going to spend money and toil at something, you want to have some idea that you can accomplish a definite goal. And in this area, there's not much traction, to put it in legal terms. There's not a lot of opportunity to be successful in litigation. And hopefully that will change. But just right now I don't feel very, yeah. Well, Larry, what do you think?
I would like to build a little bit on that. When Robin says we oppose civil commitment, just be clear that every state has civil commitment. What we're talking about is sex offender specific tracks for committing sex offenders, but every state has a civil commitment process, and that's what causes this challenge not to gain the traction, because civil commitment is constitutional. Every state does it. What's the key to it is that the sex offender civil commitment is they use a different determination for what constitutes mental illness. In a normal civil commitment, you've got to have a mental illness that renders the person a danger to themselves, an imminent danger to themselves or the community. And there's a robust process by which they go through. The burden is clearly on the state to prove. In sex offender civil commitment, it's a lot looser, but the Supreme Court has found that the processes are sufficient. That in the case of the Minnesota, they found that the process for review was sufficient and robust enough that the person conceivably could get out, although apparently no one does, or very few do. So they found that civil commitment in and of itself is not unconstitutional. So what you have to guard against is the process by which people can be put into civil commitment. You've got to narrow that funnel on the legislative side of what constitutes a crime, and you've got to continue to try to increase the barriers of what the standards of proof are on the legislative side, so you build a bigger and bigger wall around commitment, and then you got to build a more robust defense system so that the person whose commitment is sought has the legal and the psychological expert resources, and those have to be provided on the public side, because usually these people have served prison sentences and have very little or no resources. So all those are legislative fixes that need to be made, but in terms of the legalities, the Supreme Court has said it is not unconstitutional. It is unconstitutional to civilly commit people, and they are the final arbiter of whether or not something is constitutional.
So did that help answer your question? It's not a happy answer, obviously, but
it pretty much confirmed what I had already thought. We were just we have a Dallas member in our Texas Voices whose son is facing this, and it's just
state?
Texas.
Well, in Texas, I don't know about how robust the process is, but they have community civil commitment, so at least you don't get locked up like you do in Moose Lake, Minnesota.
We hope. Yeah.
I'm not saying civil commitment is ever good, but everybody up there gets locked up in a facility.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, similar, but thank you for that input. I appreciate it.
All right. Yes, thanks, ma'am. Alan. All righty. And we have one more person, and then we'll, I think, call it an evening. You're on the air.
Hello. My question involves the amicus brief that was filed in Oklahoma regarding the driver's licenses. I was wondering what the purpose of the amicus brief and how it plays in with the case, and how long the time frame may or may not be for review in the Ninth Circuit.
Well, the Ninth Circuit has nothing to do with that case.
Yes, the Tenth Circuit.
Yeah, that's the Tenth Circuit.
Yeah, I wrote down the wrong thing.
So, okay, Robin, that's yours because you've masterminded this, and I'm gonna let you, unless you need my help.
Well, right now, and I have not checked. It's been 2 weeks since I checked Pacer for the Carney case. And that's how I'm most familiar with it. We got involved in that particular case because we were asked to, and the attorney who's the counsel of record, Andrew Barr, I believe is his name. Called one afternoon, and he had been in touch with Professor Corzine at the Wake Forest University Appellate Advocacy Clinic, who handled the Packingham amicus brief, and had found out about us, or had found some contact information about us, because he was actively seeking amici support. He had been handed the case, had been asked by the Tenth Circuit to develop a supplemental brief to assist, essentially.
Robin, if you could you back up a little bit, and rather than those many details, would you mind just sort of saying, what does the amicus do? I mean, how does it help? How does it potentially help the case?
Well, the purpose of amicus is a friend of the court brief is essentially to give the court broader perspective and to allow the court input from parties who are not before the court, but who have an interest in the outcome of the case. So, and actually, depending on the case, amici are really very important in this particular era, because that's what helps for courts to see a deeper perspective or appreciate the full contours of a question that's been presented. So that's the purpose of them. It essentially just expands the scope of the legal forum. Mm-hmm. And provides greater opportunity, greater depth to the court.
Okay. And what's the, at this point, do we know anything about timing? It's hard to do.
It's sitting before the court. That's all I can tell you. What the court is doing with it and how it has docketed it, we just don't know. I've sent an email to Andrew Barr asking for an update. I haven't heard anything. I probably need to touch base with Professor Corzine because he's the person that actually signed the brief. But at this point, you know, circuit courts operate by their own schedules.
they make their own schedules. There's a lot of hurry up and wait when you get to these, especially these civil type cases.
There's nothing that can. Larry's right. The onus is on the moving party to continue to move, but you've got to do that within reason. You can't piss the court off by constantly.
And an appeal is a slightly different situation because the court is going to move this case as they see fit. If they're going to hold oral argument, parties can request oral argument. They have to schedule oral arguments if they're going to hold them. They may ask for additional briefing to clarify something they heard at oral argument. I mean, these cases play out sometimes over years. Even when they get to the Court of Appeals, it may take 2 years for it to work its way through oral argument and supplemental briefing. So you'll get a decision when the case has been decided.
When they feel like it, what it feels like to me. I know.
Let me add one more thing because this has come up a time or two. This may be directed to her or may not. I'm not sure exactly whether it would satisfy her question, but I want to make sure everybody has the opportunity to hear this. When you in these amicus settings, the parties that are being represented, such as say NARSAL, we don't have the level of control over these briefs that you might think we have. And that's because ultimately, even though we're the party that's represented, we're not the attorney that signs his name or her name to the brief. And in addition to that, the counsel of record, who is the person who's handling the case in chief and is normally the person who's coordinating the amici, the counsel of record has a large amount of influence over the development of those particular amici and does not want anybody or any organization to be submitting a brief that might do harm to the case in chief. So that's why we don't always get everything we want in the amici is exactly in the way that we'd like, perhaps, if that makes sense.
That's a good point to bring up.
Very good point.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for your question. I think that was really good. We don't have any more questions in queue.
No more board questions?
No more board questions. Nope. So,
how many questions did we take? Quite a few.
We took quite a few. And at this point, though, I want to thank everyone for being on the call and sticking with us. through all of this. If you come up with a question later on that you just totally forgot to ask, you can always contact us through the website or write an email to director. It is singular, right? director@narsil.org,
yeah.
And one of us can get back to you that way. So with that, I will stop the recording and take everybody off Q&A, and we'll say goodnight for the evening. Thank you all so much for being on the call. Have a very
Thank
good
you, Brenda.
Evening to one and all.